So we continue the Life Divine, Mother's Wine. But before we continue, just to take a quick summary of all that we have read. Existence is a mystery, not only our existence, that we can explain, I am born from so and so. But is it really an explanation? Consciousness is a mystery. Actually, if you look at this creation, everything is a mystery. Creation is a mystery. How come something has come into being out of nothingness? Apparently, that's what we are told. So it's a mystery. And sometimes when we try to explain the mystery, we make it even more mysterious. So when we hear that, well, there is God who is the creator, who is nothingness, so it becomes even more difficult to comprehend how something has come out of nothingness. Then we are told it's on an illusion. That makes it even more worse. Who is the dreamer? And whose is the dream? So if we are not to stop halfway in our pursuit or quest of the ultimate meaning of existence, the ultimate sense of the mystery, then we should read the Life Divine. But if we are satisfied with mental conceptions and all kinds of things that we have heard from tradition, then it's a different matter altogether. But anyone who looks at this world with open eyes and at the same time tries to read, delve into or experience all that has been talked about this world from different standpoints, it is invariably reaches a point where we say, no, there is something which is missing, like the missing piece of a jigsaw puzzle. That's how creation is. And it's interesting why it has been made like a puzzle. Because when you solve the puzzle, then we grow. So creation is a puzzle. And if we solve the puzzle, then we grow in consciousness by whatever means we try to solve it. And then when we have grown sufficiently enough, then we are revealed the ultimate reality which we find embodied in the Life Divine. So the life divine is the creator speaking to the creation. That's how I look at it. He is not only revealing to us all the building blocks, He is Himself taking us on a tour de world, not cycling but walking with us. So there is a great detail that Sri Aurobindo goes into. It's like if the maker takes us through a house, mansion. So He is revealing to us that, look, this is what I have made for you. We are all His portions. But we don't understand it. We live in a very small fraction of what I call as myself, very little. From there I look at the house, the mansion, from there I understand the world. But the Maker wants us to step out and go through the entire many tired mansion that this world is. And then He says that all this is for you, for us to stay in and to take delight in it. But there is something we have to do. So we see in Life Divine, first He explains to us this mansion. And then He says that man is meant to reclaim it. I have built it for you. But to reclaim it, there is something that is required. So all sensible parents, even if they are super rich, they don't hand over everything to the child unless he has gone through a process. So otherwise, we know what happens. Anything which is given prematurely when we are not ready, we just like those asuras who entered heaven because they wanted a boon and Shiva said, okay, come in. You take my name and go in. So they all went to heaven and gods are very unhappy about his decision. But they can't tell anything to Shiva. When he will pick up his trident, we don't know. Even gods are scared. So they let them come, and all of them, they go to heaven. And they start fighting over whom does Kamdhenu belong to. So the gods tell him, this is a divine socialism or divine communism we practice here. Kamdhenu is everybody's, but you have to take it according to your need. You can't just do for my greed, I'll take it. No, no, no. Whoever is mighty will keep the Kamdhenu and he will sell the milk and earn money. So they start fighting. And finally they start fighting and the whole heaven turns into hell. Until the mother Parvati intervenes and she has her own way and they move out. So this is the whole thing, that it takes time. And transformation is for that very purpose. We have graduated in the first school of nature, which is in ignorance. There is something which we gain by going through ignorance, as the Isha Upanishad says. Other is the knowledge that comes through ignorance. Verily, other that comes through knowledge. So there is a knowledge which comes through the ignorance, like we understand how the human body works and we become a doctor. But what comes by knowledge? By ignorance. All this is ignorance. With MBBS, we should at the end put I. MBBS, ignorance. It's not that it is meaningless. It is a knowledge which is practical, helpful at a point of time. But then it doesn't tell us who owns the car, machine. It doesn't tell us what are the possible uses of this machine. It doesn't tell us that this machine can be upgraded into a flying machine. It doesn't tell us all that. So this is the machine, I can learn to repair it. So this is what is, ignorance is not absence of knowledge, it is partial knowledge. And this partial knowledge pursues us even when we take to spiritual life, because at different levels there is a different view of this creation. So one of them, which traditionally is one of the views, that there is the one consciousness, but it is perceived by us through a broken mirror. So because of the broken mirror or a distorted mirror, whatever way we want to put it, we don't see the one as it is. We see it a distorted reality here. And this is a wonderful way of looking at it. But the problem is, who broke the mirror and who distorted it and why it happened at all? But those who understand it this way, take it that if we are within in this world and looking at life through the mirror of the mind, we'll never see truth. We'll always see partial glimpses, this side, that side. We'll try to add it up, sum up. We may be generous, we may be intolerant, we may be judgmental, whatever it is. But all these views are ignorant views. The other is that, well, we have to come out of the mind and discover the one consciousness, which is everywhere, which is being reflected through the medium of the mind. But then when we enter into the mind, into that which is beyond the mind, I'm speaking of the Satchitananda, the Brahman consciousness, then all this becomes incomprehensible. There is a splendor. Everybody who has touched, even partially experienced, it is vast, it is full of splendor, dazzling lights, Ananda, almighty, omniscience, omnipotence. But then if we come here, it is just the opposite. So there are various explanations to it. One explanation is, God made this world perfect, man spoilt it. But man asked that, who made me? And why did you make such an imperfect creature who can't handle what you have made? So obviously this explanation is not satisfactory. The other is, everything is wonderful about the world, but man by his karma has made a mess out of it. Again, seems very plausible. But why the wisdom and the power is not given to us? After all, when people do karma, it's in ignorance. We are ignorant. So many things we do, selfishness, egoism is something which we are born with. So then how much can we really impute such a person for apparently committing sin, etc., and hold him guilty for a world he has not made? Sri Aurobindo says very powerfully, poignantly, that we can't hold man guilty for what the world is, because he was not even consulted in making the world. So you suddenly find yourself here, surrounded with ignorance, massive ignorance. Slowly we have to learn everything. Through error we have to learn. So obviously this is an unsatisfactory explanation. Then there is another fantastic explanation: all this is illusion. Then in that case, who knows if even the experience of God is not an illusion? Buddha almost said that. Almost, that there is no really creator. It's all, you can escape from this illusion and an ignorance or nature. But there is nothing like a creator. So there are various ways. Of course, material scientist doesn't raise those questions. He says, Baba, don't ask me these things. World is what it is. I can do little tinkering, denting, painting. The problem with a material scientist is, so long as he does this, it is fine. But when he starts pronouncing on the mystery of creation and creator, then there is a problem. Then you have to tell him, look, this is not a field you have even felt like engaging in. So these are the ways world has been explained. But something is missing. And that missing link is the link between the one and the many. This is the original mystery. The mystery of birth. Birth by birth is meant a form. So there is one. Everybody says there is the one. But what are then these many, many, many forms? It's simple to say that yes, God dwells in all. But the human mind is such an instrument that it invariably, even that it distorts. Which God dwells in all? Mera wala. Sects, my idea of God. Because through all the conceptions and ideas and experiences, based on that we have formed religions, sects, cults. We limit the one who is infinite and acts in complete freedom. He is infinite. You can't bind him by laws and rules. So to understand this mystery from that point of view, from the divine's point of view. So he is in a way explaining himself to all of us and revealing to us the future plan in the life divine. So all who are interested in knowing what God intends to do with this world and why this world is, should read the life divine, because he really exposes it completely. There are also certain philosophies that say, why you want to tax your mind all this? Come out of the mind. God is beyond mind. Mind has to be dropped. That means, I am basically saying, when I say mind has to be dropped, it means that this instrument, which has its own little use, I am throwing it away. Next it will be, what is the use of body? Body has to be dropped. This is how Mayavad takes an extreme step. Mind has to be dropped. Now mind has to be, Sri Aurobindo says, mind has not to be dropped, it has to be transformed. It has its own origin. There is a divine mind which has conceived this grand plan of the cosmos. And when we read the life divine, it's a yoga. Why? Because our mind is limited, sees things in a limited way. It's very easy to say drop the mind. With mind you cannot understand, go beyond the mind. Beyond the mind also, we can't understand, but you will be out of this rut. It's a very selfish attitude and very imperfect. But what he does is, the life divine is an exercise. But an exercise in for our intellectual mind to widen, broaden, uplifted, ultimately till actually this is an experience one can have with the life divine, that it takes us to that point where the mind is ready to receive some influx of the divine mind, divine supermind, through this process. So it's a yoga, it is not a book, just an intellectual book to be understood. Yes, its action is largely on the mind, because the mind has to be prepared. Now a prepared mind becomes an instrument for the divine. But a mind which is cast away, we may have the experience, but that means all this creation, all this means nothing. Individually one may escape. So that's where Shobindo reveals step by step. And last time we had stopped at the supreme truth consciousness, supermind as creator, and the triple status of the supermind. So now he reveals that there is a missing link between the one and the many, and that is the supermind. Meaning thereby how the one became the many. So we can conceive of it. There is a very beautiful, simple analogy and an example. That how does somebody write an epic? Now when we try to, let's say, the Mahabharata. Now if we try to understand the mind of the Vyas, of the heart of Vyas, by starting from below upward, through reading of Mahabharata, it is very difficult to start with, till date, why he used the word Mahabharat. He could have simply said Bharatvarsh or Bharat, Bharatam or some other Mahabharat. So to my intuitive sense, I have not read this anywhere, is that because Mahabharat contains in itself, because it's there in something which has been spoken about Mahabharat. It is said, and Shobindo writes that in Foundations of Indian Culture, that all that is there in Bharat is there in this Mahabharat. And whatever is not in this is not there anywhere in Bharat. Meaning thereby, there are things in Mahabharat about Bharat. If we don't read Mahabharat, Bharat is a piece of land extending from here to there and up and down. Yes, physical map of India is also there, just Independence Day, so we can touch upon it. From Gandhar, people quote, you know, if you see the map of Mahabharat time, we had once put it for our All India magazine cover. So people said, but this is not map of India. I said, this is the map of united, undivided India, which you will see in Mahabharata times. Actually, if we read through the Mahabharata and the stories, where did Arjun go and where all the same culture was, you will see the map of what Mother has told as united India. It's there. Absolutely. The whole thing is there. Map is there. So, not only physical, the layers of evolution, because it gives a whole lineage of kings, then it speaks of Dharma, which is the soul of India. It's a Dharma Granth. It is a fifth Veda. So all the secret truths discovered by the rishis are there. Countless stories are there, one after another. So when we read the Mahabharat, we know Bharat not just as a piece of land with some culture, with some rituals and some gods and all the things, but about those things in Bharat which are hidden layer behind layers, which we can't see. That's why Shrubindo once said that somebody who has not read the Mahabharata does not understand India. He cannot understand India. So to understand India, we should read Mahabharata. Compulsory text in our history. So this, you don't have to then rewrite history, as they say. You read Mahabharata, you understand India. Mahabharata. But we don't understand. If you just read Mahabharata, people have different views. Somebody will say, oh, what a gory story. I've even heard somebody say, it is only to show to man that how horrific war is. Then what about Sri Krishna's vision? He is taking everybody inside, crushing them under his teeth like nice meals. What about that? So, if we look at it like that, the people who say Mahabharata encourages violence, obviously you are seeing it from one limited angle. But when you read the Mahabharata, you ask, what is Mahabharata story about? And if you ask Vyas, Rishi, he would probably say, you know what? I had to write about Krishna. What? But Krishna in the Mahabharata war is simply a sarathi. He says, haven't I written that he is aparimeya? The only term used in Mahabharata to describe Krishna is you cannot measure him. Aparimeya. He says, but the whole story is about the unfolding of the whole event centered around Krishna. He is the soul of the epic. Now, this is how, looking at creation, we cannot understand. Like looking at a painting, we cannot understand. Sometimes, as mother says, people saw those palette scrapings. There was that famous painter. And he would paint and, palette scrappings, he'll put it, that brush on the another easel board because it's a waste. And someone came to some, and this fellow was very poor because nobody could appreciate his paintings. And a rich man suddenly came and he also couldn't appreciate the painting. But when he saw that place where all the waste of the palette brushes were put there, he looks at it and says, wow, what a modern art. I have never seen this. Can you sell it to me? I'll give you millions. This fellow was dumb. Was it Rembrandt? I'm forgetting the name. So he said, gladly. But that was not a painting at all. So this is how people come to India, take pictures of slums and say, this is India. Poor on hunger index, poor on democracy, poor on happiness. So there are views that we form which are very incomplete and imperfect based on our limited view of things. So who can tell us the full view is only the one who has made it. We have to ask, Ask the painter, what did you try to make? Then he will tell us. So we have to first contact the creator before we can understand creation. It's a very simple logic. But as I said, there are different poises of creation, creator. And therefore, when we touch one side, we look at creation and it appears one way. We look at it from another poise of the same creator. It's like the same man may be playing the role of a husband, a son, a child, a father or mother, and friend, a teacher, all these, the same man. Depending on when and where you meet him, you will draw a conclusion about him. But the conclusion will not be correct. So you have to know the man who is behind all these different roles he is playing. So we have to understand the creator in his totality. And the Gita uses a wonderful word. Shobindo speaks about it, and so wonderful, irreplaceable word I feel. Samagram mam. Rarest of rare is he who understands me in my totality. Samagram mam. So Shobindo has written all this after his deepest experience, the most profound experience, as we know, when he writes The Life Divine, he had at least three experiences and the fourth was on the way. One was what is called as Nirvana, the complete consciousness is still, so the reflection of the truth is unbroken. Then he had the experience of Vasudevam Sarvamiti Samahatma Chadurlabha. He sees the one divine in everyone, everywhere. So the entire value system changes. Because ordinarily we judge people outwardly, but he is able to see something else. Shri Krishna shows him all those criminals and etc. And he says, in the superior pride, people often call them chhotte log. But these are the ones whom I am lifting up. I am raising. So his whole thing changes. All this idea of big, small, everything begins to change. And then he has the third experience of Parabrahman. Dwelling for 18 hours in Parabrahman. 1913. And already his experiences, he was on the way to the supermind. He was shown that that's where the missing link is. Between one and the many, there is this missing link. And how to understand this missing link, which we read last time. What are the processes involved in creation? There is the one without the many or without any. Ekameva dvitiyam. And then there is the urge to create. This urge is from within him, his own shakti. And now when he creates, what is the urge? It is in this single idea, ekoham bahushyam. He wants to become many. So initially, in the first poise, like, as I said, the author of Mahabharata, he has an idea. Let's write Krishna Leela in a different way. If you read here that Mangala Bhavana Mangalhari, it is Ramayana in a very small nutshell, a different way. All the major events are shown from a different standpoint. Rama is going through them all about his greatness. It doesn't show in that detail. So he says, let me write it in a different way altogether. So that is the first poise of the creator, where many are there but very vague. So creator has decided to create many. But who are these many? Somewhere they are there, like the characters of a great poem, which are there in the mind of the poet, but they have not yet become distinct. So that is the first poise of the creator. That, Shobindu says, the three layers of the supermind. First layer, where one is predominant, and the many, and who is the many? All of us. They are there as, they are vaguely like a parent saying, I think we should conceive a child. The child is not there. Perhaps initially, when the process takes place, they know. Only the mother knows. Child is there. Nobody knows. It's very indistinct, vague. And then the next layer, where the many and the one, both are there. Because now the characters are developing. Now the baby is born, but he is still, it knows, there is the baby and the mother and the father. But they are very intimately connected, as if joined to each other. And the third is, when the baby goes out into the adventure of the world, but the parents are always there with the baby. The baby doesn't know. Initially, when he goes out, in the beginning, there is a good contact with the parent. So these are the three layers. First is, when the one is there, many are vaguely inside. The second is, when the many, the idea is being formed about the many. And the third is, when the adventure has started. Child is going to hostel for the first time. And everything is uncertain. The great adventure, and child is very close to the parent. Parents are giving, take this, take that, everything they want to give. As if they even pack puri alu, as if this is going to last all through his studies. Child also, he is also very happy. At the same time, he is apprehensive about the adventure. And then he goes away. And when he goes away and he forgets the parents, that's avidya. But parents, they never forget. Day and night. The child who has gone away is even more in the consciousness of the parent. So the creation forgets. It is even made to forget. Why it is made to forget? He does not want a child who is every day calling up, Papa, I am feeling sick and tired. Mama, I am missing your food. That is also not good, no? Parents will not be happy with that state also. I am coming back. I can't be study outside. It is too dangerous, too difficult. So see this fine balance. So avidya serves a purpose. It makes us forget the divine. But in the process, we grow through the challenges of life for a long time. And then the time comes when we want to reclaim our, that the whole thing about Gurukul. Gurukul is not about strictness, etc. Gurukul is there where you are now in a school where you are learning all about life, about creation. You can't say there, I am the king's son, I am so and so's son. You learn and grow. And then a time comes when one is ready. And when one is ready, then the life divine comes into the hands. How it comes, where it comes. So I personally believe it is not a book that one buys from a store. I mean, outwardly, yes. But when something in us is ready, it draws us and we find the book in our hands. That's how we all sit together and read the life divine. So these are the three layers of the supermind, and based on what we glimpse, we have these three ideas of the divine. One is that there is only one and many is an illusion. Why? Because that is how the first layer of supermind, where there is the one and the many are all vaguely felt. Advaita. The second is where one is there and the many are there, both are there. Dvaita Advaita. The wave is there and the ocean is there. And the third is where there is Dvaita. There is the many and there is the one. They are thinly connected. Maybe through worship, like a river flowing into the sea. But otherwise the river has its own life and the ocean has its own life. So these are the three poises. One is where there is only the ocean. There is nothing else. All waves are an illusion. They come from the one, they go back to the one. They don't have any permanent reality. Permanent reality is only the ocean. The second is, the river is there flowing into the sea. But otherwise, river has its own life, its own existence. Through prayer, through worship, we can join. The third is, or the second is, this is the third one. The second is, wave is there. It has its own power. It is its own reality. Those who deny the reality of a wave don't know what tsunami can do. Tsunami is a wave. But it is a wave which can demolish everything. So wave has its own reality. It has its reality because it's coming up from the ocean. And then there are different modifications. But all three, Shurabindo says, are three poises of the one. There are three steps in this soul creation process. And to solve the riddle of the cosmos creation, we have to understand and live all the three at the same time. And that he will explain to us very beautifully. If we take one position or the other, which traditional schools take up, then we can't solve the riddle. But when we, and where is this all three together? That is what the supermind is. Short of supermind, we can get one glimpse or the other. If we get glimpse of the one without the many or ekamevidityam, then the many appears illusory. If we get glimpse of one and the many, then we say, okay, this is a leela, a temporary reality, but we still don't understand the secret. Or if we take the third view, dvaita, man and God can never be one. But sometimes through worship, through typical dvaita example, one day we will rise from the grave and he will take us home as disembodied beings. So these are, all three are imperfect views very evidently. So Sri Aurobindo comes with the gospel of the supermind. Why Sri Aurobindo gave this, could give this? For a very simple reason. He went beyond the rishis of yore. As simple as that. Didn't the rishis glimpse the supermind? Yes, they did. There is a difference between glimpsing and entering that reality. As people often quote this, Swami Vivekananda showed him the way. Yes, Swami Vivekananda standing on the highest layer of the mind, intuitive mind, he sees there is that. Like Yajnavalk, he also says there is a lid. I see the truth there. But I don't know what that truth is. What is the law of truth? How does it operate in this world? I don't know. So Sri Aurobindo is not content by seeing the lid. He is not content by knowing there is a great truth. He says, I want to enter into that truth. But the beauty is, when he enters into that truth, he doesn't say, ah, wonderful, now I understand. Now he says, this I want for all. This is the way to live a divine life. But I cannot be satisfied with only myself living a divine life. I want everybody should experience it so that they can live a divine life. So what is the choice he makes? He cannot do it unless he renounces, comes back to earth. That's why the mother speaks of the great sacrifice. He renounced the realization in his own body to hasten the collective realization. So he comes and tells us there is a possibility. We can lead a divine life. So there are two kinds of people. One is the materialist will always deny everything. But even the seers and sages, they deny. They contradict. No, no, no. And they quote the scriptures. How can you experience something which the Rishi of the Upanishad did not experience? What do you reply to that? But there are some people, like those who joined Rama's army, Bandar Bhalu, they just have faith. We trust you. The whole world may lie, but you can't do that. This we know. So these are the ones who have been drawn towards this ideal of the life divine. Because of this faith in what Sri Aurobindo says. It starts with that. And just one little definition where he says in chapter 15, we have to regard therefore this all containing, all originating, all consummating supermind as the nature of the divine being. Not indeed in its absolute self-existence, which is Parabrahman, but in its action as the Lord and creator of its own worlds. This is the truth of that which we call God. So this is what God is. And if we see from that standpoint, we are in for very marvelous discoveries, because this is a God who does not make the world. He becomes the world. He is the maker and the world he made. He is the vision and he is the seer. He is the knowledge. He is the knower. And he is the known. He is the lover. He is the love. And he is the beloved. Because if we see these three levels, and most importantly, it reveals to us our own origin. How beautiful. Where is our origin? Our origin is in the supermind. That is where Jivatma has come into existence. This is a question which, at least, you know, people say it's a portion, fine, but nowhere, at least to my satisfaction, I got an answer. Where did Jivatmas come into existence? That other bird sitting on top, Dwasuparna. So, where did it come into existence? How come? This is a nutty question. Traditionally, the answer is, the sense of a separate Jivatma is an illusion. In which case, the problem is, why should I free myself from an illusion if my reality is also an illusion? The big problem. So this is the traditional answer, that this idea of Jivatma is itself an illusion and there is none bound, none free, none seeking to be free. So that makes everything collapse. So these are the mental downpitch, but Sri Aurobindo takes us to reality. And he tells us that this is where we are, our origin is. Okay, so we'll just. This is on the last page we had read. Three poises. One is the primary poise, we read about it. The secondary poise, where the divine consciousness stands back in the idea from the movement which it contains. So now Vyas has started developing the characters. For a moment he becomes those characters, Dushasan, Duryodhan, Bhima, Arjun. But he is always aware that he is Vyas. And see, in that poise there is unity. In his mind, Dushasan and Arjun or Bhima are not fighting with each other. They are not angry at each other like people in the green room. That's why supermind is a consciousness of unity. All the opposites unite there. All of them find their fulfillment. But when third poise is when these characters are ready to be casted. And when they are cast, they start becoming independent realities. They are as if disconnected with the whole, and therefore they suffer, they struggle, they win, they lose. All this happens. Like the story of Ramayana is never complete without the story of Jai Vijay, because it remains incomplete. So that is how we have to find the missing link of our story, and that is in the supermind. Otherwise we'll never understand our life. A third poise of the supermind would be attained if the supporting concentration were no longer to stand at the back, as it were, of the movement, inhabiting it with a certain superiority to it, and so following and enjoying. Why does he follow and enjoy? When mother was asked that, what is the difference between the supramental view of things and the human view? She says it is the difference between somebody who knows all the play. So if you ask Sri Aurobindo, he'll say everything will be fine, have faith. There will be a new creation. So you ask him, how do you know? He will say, because I am the creator who has taken a human form. Prove it to us. So he says, I have given the life divine, read it. No, I don't want to read. Then third thing he will say, wait. Wait and see. I am the one who has written the pages. I know this story is incomplete. There are more things to happen. You are seeing it only till interval. So this is how this whole thing is to be seen. So the third poise is where he stands behind. And see, within the mind you can do everything. It's in one space. In the mind, when the whole story has developed, there is no space and time. So initially, in the supramental poise, there is no space and time. It begins to form toward the end. Like in the mind, when you have all the characters, or a painting which has not manifested, or a poem, it's all within. You can delete, you can change, you can alter. You can't say, where are the characters? Somebody, the poet will not say, you know, in my left brain in that area is Dushasan, in my right brain in that area is Bhima. He'll say, please show to some doctor, I think you need. He says, they're all in my mind space. In mind space is like continuity at one point, simultaneously. They're not there in time frames. Space and time frames are not there. But when they start manifesting in space and time, then we see the story develops. Then if he has to change a character, he has to now change everybody, because there is a link. He suddenly can't show that Dushasan one day walks onto the field next day and he says, I am, please forgive me, brother, I have done great mistakes. You know, the story will make no sense. There are many links which have formed in the story. Not that he cannot change, but there has to be some process even in the change. There has to be a change of heart, there has to be something. So that's why when there is a connectivity link, all the interconnected links, and in the supermind we understand all the interconnected links, including our individual links with everyone else, which today we don't understand. We think, oh, this person is brother, father, husband, wife, child, friend. We don't understand that link. Therefore, we suffer and we make all the wrong moves. But in supermind, we understand how each one is some aspect of the cosmic poet. Then there is no more fight. Even if there is a fight, it is a friendly fight. Because you know, we are not enemies. This person is representing this aspect of the one, and he is representing this aspect of the one, and I am representing this aspect of the one. And while I have to be true to the truth that is in me, the other person is also have to be true to that aspect in him. That's how we see Krishna. When he talks about Karna, Duryodhan, he sees the divine element in everyone. And that's how we can solve the problem of fight, I mean quarrels, by seeing some divine element in each one. But we are so much into seeing all the mud that we miss the lotus. Okay. So anyways, that's a bit of psychology. So he says, thus emphasizing the sole truth of the Unitarian consciousness, we observe the play of the divine unity erroneously rendered by our mentality into the terms of real difference. But not satisfied with correcting this error of the mind by the truth of a higher principle, we assert that the play itself is an illusion. We can't understand the difference. But we have experienced the one only in the unity, ekame vidvityam. So we say it is an illusion because there is no sense, it doesn't make sense. Or, emphasizing the play of the one in the many, we declare a qualified unity and regard the individual soul as a sole form of the supreme, but would assert the eternity of this qualified existence and deny altogether the experience of a pure consciousness in an unqualified oneness. Meaning thereby that while each of us are a sole portion of the supreme, we are destined to remain this. We can never unite with the one without the peril of losing the consciousness of individuality. So we can either choose remain this soul and which is connecting with the one consciousness, or else we can join and merge and forget. So there is no divine life here. We are enjoying the play with the one consciousness. But this many, this ego-burdened life, all this remains inexplicable. Or again, emphasizing the play of difference, we assert that the supreme and the human soul are eternally different and reject the validity of an experience which exceeds and seems to abolish that difference. So this is what the Dvaita is, and behind all the differences between Hindu, Muslim, Hindu, Christian, Semitic religion and Sanatana Dharma, this is the core problem. Because while Indian thought takes one of these positions, it has Dvait, but it also has Advait, it has Dvait Advait. But in the Christian and Semitic thought in general, Islam, there is only Dvait. So there is no way that the many or can even conceive there is one. They killed, who was it? Shams, he was killed. Then this fellow, Malana Rum, they have been mystics who said that I am one with the Lord, and they were killed. You cannot. This is blasphemy. So there is a fundamental difference, and it cannot be resolved unless you rise to the higher principle. And that's what Sri Aurobindo says. But the position, and therefore the many have to always live according to the law given by someone, which is a very earthly law. Because there is no other way. There is nothing like a divine law or a divine connection with the Creator. They are forever separated. After so many years, you can rise, and when half the world is finished, you have to finish it. Then only you can rise and become one with the Creator. That's why they want to finish this world. Because otherwise, they will lie in grave. It's a reality, I'm saying, that, you know, this is the doctrine. Unless you kill all the Jews, unless you kill all the kafirs, you cannot get your own mukti. So you see, poor fellows, strange situation. So this is the problem behind, the whole logic works like that. But the position that we have now firmly taken absolves us from the necessity of these negations and exclusions. We see that there is a truth behind all these affirmations, but at the same time, an excess which leads to an ill-founded negation. We are on the last page, 160, which we had read last time. Affirming, as we have done, the absolute absoluteness of that, not limited by our ideas of unity, not limited by our ideas of multiplicity, affirming the unity as a basis for the manifestation of the multiplicity, and the multiplicity as the basis for the return to oneness and the enjoyment of unity in the divine manifestation. We need not burden our present statement with these discussions or undertake the vain labor of enslaving to our mental distinctions and definitions the absolute freedom of the divine infinite. So this is what is meant when it is said that we are playing a role. We should play it consciously. We should know the storyline. We should know that the person whom we have to fight, even if he seems our hardcore opponent, is not our enemy. There is no enemy. Yet we may be called upon to slay. Why? Because oneness is about the collective march of mankind. It's not just about me. So within myself, I have to remove all the lower nature, ignorance. Then I play the role. I know that the opponent is also a soul evolving. And I am a soul evolving. And who knows, in next life, now we are fighting. In next life, we don't want to see each other's face. And in next life, we are husband and wife. We have to see each other's face. We have to live together. God is giving us the great challenge. Now you do it. And next life, we are bosom friends. This is how evolution takes place. You see all the stories. Supanka, next life she gets moksha. Then there is another character, Ashwatthama. He becomes one of the Manus when he is rid of this burden. All of them, if you see their future life as it is projected, Dushasan, he is supposed to eventually become a saintly fellow. So there is hope for everyone, because all of us are part of the divine, and while we have to do what we have to do, but it should not be done based on ego reactions, but based on the deeper knowledge, the deeper truth of our own self, of others, and of the world. So we'll meet after 10 minutes break, and now we'll continue the next chapter. Thank you.